This is 60 Seconds with Wayne Deakin. Wayne, are you ready?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. Number one. I don't know why I looked over there. Number one, what is the most frustrating app on your phone?
The train line.
Thank you very much. Number two, best rebrand you've seen?
Oh, I'm going to say Sweet Green, which is a US
love that thing. Love that. Thank you very much. Bam. Least favorite color.
Least favorite color. Sort of poo brown.
I think I agree.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree.
Favorite brand right now?
Favorite brand right now? Oh, man, that's too hard to call. Move on.
Okay. Do I look like a rat or a fish?
Fish. Rat-fish combination.
Fair enough. A city that everyone should know about?
Seoul.
We'll come on to that. And lastly, your career in a noise.
In a noise? What the fuck?
That's a pretty good noise.
It's a word rather than a noise.
And it's important to get the at the beginning of that.
Yeah.
So it's, what the fuck?
I'm still working it out.
Yeah. Well, Wayne, thanks for coming and sitting here with me and Sean Williams, managing partner of Product. There's a whole load of reasons why we wanted to bring you along today. But firstly, I guess this is Untalented, right? And we want to hear about what makes you, you as a human being. But before we dive into you, you have to imagine I'm a very dumb human being. Actually, you don't have to imagine. I'm a very dumb human being. Can you explain who Wolf Ollins or what Wolf Ollins is to me?
Oh, big ask.
I'm sorry. I know it's putting you on the spot.
Well, no, that's cool. That's cool. Like, how do I explain that? I think I could also say what it's not.
Okay.
So it's probably not a traditional design or branding agency. Okay. I think there's plenty of them that sort of do mediocre work out there. I think we sit in this weird space between, are we a brand design, a brand consultancy or a creative consultancy or slightly innovation, slightly sort of consultancy. We sort of like, basically our job is we get asked by brands when they're in major inflection points to sort of help them evolve or refresh or reinvent themselves. So it sort of stretches a lot between strategy, design, and culture. Because, like, you know, the culture is just as much, you know, it's just as important for an organization or a brand as the external branding. So it's sort of stretching that. So apparently, you know, that's the sort of thing we do. It's been around for 60 years.
Wow.
Wow, yeah.
What are they known for? So is there like one rebrand that they're known for?
I think they're known for loads of things, and that's what's the interesting thing, because I think they keep evolving. And I think, you know, like, if you take some of the back in the day, you know, Heathrow Express, everything from designing the carriages to the ticketing to the identity and the experience before the word experience existed. London 2012 Olympics. Yeah, that was a big one.
Contentious.
It's contentious, but again, you know, you don't hire Wolf Ollins if you just want something that's going to become wallpaper.
Yeah,
you know, you want something that's going to, it's got a point and mean something. Tesco, they did that. You know, again, that's probably probably not everyone's sexiest brand, but it's a massive organization that's the rebrand, the refresh of that. More recently, sort of Uber, GSK. What else have we done? Like loads of
everything.
Stuff.
Everything. Yeah. Lots of like supermarket.
Yeah. Okay. Lots of interesting stuff. Google.
Yeah,
you can't forget them. Yeah. And the colours.
Yeah, rather large.
Yeah.
But I think they're brave as well, right? Wolf Ollins is an agency. I think there's so traditionally design agencies and branding agencies, it feels like they stick in their lane and do what they do well.
Yeah.
I think Wolf Ollins were definitely, when they came to us as well, it was, we're ready to be a bit brave with this and try something that is quite new.
Yeah.
And bring those worlds of brand, campaign and digital all together. So I think that's like hats off to them as well, you know.
Why? Because we have a history, Wayne, you and I.
Yeah, a good history.
History. Many a beer, many a conversation. I've tried to tempt you into many an agency and you always turn me down. But I had you in my head, let's say 2014 Wayne. at this point, I think Jam would have been going on. Yeah. You would have been like deep in the Jam, right? At Engine, right? The kind of the weird jewel of innovation and digital stuff happening in quite a traditional agency. Then you went on to AKQA.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you went on to Huge, right? So very sort of digital decade. Wow, digital decade, we're going to call that.
I love that. That's I'm going to steal that buzzword.
I think I'm going to steal that. Yeah. Yeah, the double D. What the fuck are you doing at a design agency now then? How did this happen?
Well, good question. If I circle back, I've always been a designer. Basically, so originally started in Australia in the sort of that world, and actually more in the advertising world. And I sort of the whole thing that I've done in my career is always go, what's interesting, and what's the next thing, or what's cool, what's the best way that I can design at scale. So like the whole Jam thing was really interesting because I think it was probably one of the first social media agencies.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and before sort of people really understood about experience design, I think it was sort of early in that field. Mm-hmm. Same with AKQA. That was always very, you know, it's a shiny, amazing design agency. And Huge is known for its design. And for me, the reason why I sort of pivoted back into sort of design is I think design has become more interesting now. Mm-hmm. Whereas before it was too flat. It was like very graphic. And I've never been. I used to get bored as a graphic designer of graphic design because it was felt one dimensional. Yeah. But now you can design like in so many ways. Mm. So I think it's like if you're working with a company that creates a capital D in design and understands that design can be the environment or the metaverse or an identity or something like that, that becomes really interesting. Because otherwise it gets...
Design isn't staying in lane anymore.
I think they've become... And actually for me, I think the next frontier is brand. Like, and I'm not just saying that as like, oh, I work at a brand place and hey, come and work with us. But I think like people have got... you know, technology is sort of like got quite equalized. Everyone's running off the same sort of tech stack, you know, or this platform or that platform. And like everything's got a bit boring. And actually brands and actually... creating relationships with brands, I think that's more interesting because like we've all sort of gone, yeah, we need technology, amazing, make it click, make it move, use an app, and like, ooh, amazing.
Yeah.
And now it's sort of like, okay, everyone's doing the same shit. So like, what's the difference? Well, the difference is creating a relationship with the person and making you feel part of a tribe or a brand. And I think that becomes more interesting.
Did it ever feel like a big risk or a potential wrong decision?
No, not yet.
No. I guess I asked that because historically a place like Wolf Olin's wasn't known for digital experience. So you must go in with a few alarm bells ringing on.
Yeah, but like, okay, so I think I don't care the name. You know, I know it's easy for me to say I've worked at some famous names, but I don't care about the name above the door. It's about the people. Yeah. And so Sarah, the CEO, is really progressive and interesting. And I think what's really cool about Wolf Olin's is that it's never stuck in one swim lane or one thing. It's always constantly reinventing and challenging. And like, so for me, that felt like a good home and a good playground. And I think there wasn't any risk. I think they were doing experience before it was even called experience. You know, and now it's like, well, yeah, that's a good question. So I guess everybody's got a different sort of like definition of experience. But the way I look at it is through brand experience, you know, rather than just pure experience design, digital product and things like that. Because I think it's the collective experience that you have with a brand, the collective relationship. So the way it surfaces visually, in motion as well, in sort of you know, the flow or the experience of a product, and it's the holistic thing that you get from experiencing and a brand.
That includes like physically as well, right?
Physically,
like how you interact with a brand, like touching it and or entering a, you know, a store or something, and how you feel,
or even the words you use. You know, John Lewis used the words partner rather than a sales assistant, so it's, and it has a partnership mentality. You know, you're part of that family of John Lewis, whatever. And I think that's it's all of those things. And it's like connecting the dots in a way, rather than silo boring stuff.
When did that start happening then? So when did branding agencies suddenly get trusted to do more than the graphic stuff and the kind of identity work?
Well, I think they used to do it back in the day.
Yeah.
Like this is almost like a reinvention of the past, if you think about it. Mm. So like back in the day, you would like have a branding agency that would do loads of stuff, you know. And then it became sort of like, oh, we need to create specialist agencies that do shopper marketing, performance, design, you know, digital or whatever. And I think what's happened is like the CEO and the CMO or whoever have basically gone, well, people don't work like that anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't, especially since COVID, they don't necessarily like, you don't bump into a brand in a traditional way anymore.
Yeah.
You might see it in a feed or you might see it through word of mouth or whatever. So it's like, so I think it's like they used to do it and then nobody did it. And I think what's interesting for us is like, we're probably early pioneers in sort of jumping into this area.
Yeah.
But that's what the Wolf Wallen's way is, basically.
I think also like born out of frustration as well, right? With a lot of design agencies who used to do it, didn't do it, and then realized by not doing it, their brand is all, their complete rebrand or visual identity is ruined by
another person.
Yeah. Or a third party digital agency.
Yeah.
Who's doing it well?
Well, apart from us.
No, but give me like, imagine I'm you know, I'm my mum now, and you have to kind of explain how I've, you know, interacted with the brand, all the different channels.
Do you know? Okay, so I think like agencies aren't doing it that well.
Which agencies?
Like lots of agencies. I think clients are doing it better.
Mm.
Oh, like as in Pinterest, there's in-house.
Yeah, the in-house team. So
why do you think that is?
I think I think it's driven from the, you know, from more of a vision that whoever it is wants to break, you know, be the CEO or whatever, want to break down silos. So within the internal team, they're getting more licensed to sort of do stuff and jam together, basically. Okay. Whereas I think we're still in the agency world where there's like, you guys do this bit, you guys do that bit, you know, don't step out of your sort of play park.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what gets in the way of good work happening?
Egos, bullshit, sort of hidden agendas.
Yeah.
What's the hidden agenda?
Well, someone who's doing something for the wrong reason, rather than like, I think the reason why clients like trust creatives or designers or whatever is because they're more interested in the work than sort of like the sort of Excel line in a budget.
Okay.
So there's more transparency there.
Unless with, let's say, an account director?
No. I mean, it depends on the account. I'm not slagging off any account people. but good account people and the best account people I've worked with always care just as much about the creative work as what I do.
Okay.
And that makes the difference between a good account person. Because I think, like, I know some people don't like this, but I think everybody's involved in the creative process, not just the creatives.
Mm. How do you make that happen, though?
I think it's a vibe, basically. It's a vibe and it's a sort of feeling that you sort of, like, got to get everybody on board, what the vision is, what you want to achieve, and the fact that we're all, you know, it's like I always think great creativity is like restaurants.
Okay.
You know, the culture of a great restaurant where you're just working together, you're probably under pressure, there's a bit of madness and you can be raw and a bit sort of like, you don't have to worry too much about sort of how you act in a way. You know, you can't act in a bad way, but you're just you and you're a human and people accept you for what you are. And then at the end, you sort of go and have a beer. And everything's forgotten about.
It sounds like you're speaking of experiences where that wasn't the case somewhere.
Can
you remember a time in your career where you're like, this is the opposite of a restaurant?
Yeah, I worked back in the day. I worked for a massive advertising agency.
Okay.
And it felt like baton passing, basically. Okay. And I think a lot of designers, like particularly young designers, will probably feel like this. Whereas like, they feel at the end of the process rather than part of the process. Mm. And I think where you have a culture of baton passing where it's like, oh yeah, you go and do this, you're doing that.
Yeah.
It doesn't empower the person and it makes the work shit.
Is it small teams? Like surely when the team gets to 20 odd people, it's like, okay, how, we can't bring everybody into this creative process. Is small teams the antidote to baton passing?
No, I think it's just how you play, what your culture's like as a, you know, as a team. So team cultures. I think the most important thing as a creative leader person or whatever I do is creating a culture where people can do the best work of their career.
Mm.
And that means being honest and transparent and accepting of each other. And it also means sort of listening to others. And I think like that can be 60 people. You know, I've run teams of 100 people. And I think it's about breaking the culture into something that it shouldn't just come from the top down. It should be from the bottom up. And that's about people sharing a similar vision of where they want to go.
How does that, because a lot of agencies start out that way. And then I guess it slowly gets not the way.
Yeah.
How do you kind of, have you got a way that you make sure that environment is created when you go into a place?
Yeah, I think like no dickheads, no divas.
Just that's the rule above the door.
Rule above the door.
Okay.
I think being honest and transparent about stuff and like listening to people. Because like I think the old school way of doing creativity was sort of like, oh, I'm a creative director, I'm going to tell you exactly how to do it. Whereas I think a creative director's or design director's job is to empower his team. So it's like I think a young designer or a young person needs to feel comfortable to be able to share their point of view.
Definitely.
And like push their ideas forward. And to be honest, it's where that's going to make the work so much easier and better rather than I've got a vision, let's just follow my route and everyone just make it happen.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't work. Yeah.
I think you're right. I think definitely some creative leaders out there underestimate the power of the knowledge of a junior designer.
Yeah.
Or you know, and what they're almost so far ahead of the game in terms of what's new and tech and what tech stack or tools they're using. That's what ultimately brings in new work and exciting work.
Yeah, and different thinking because they're coming from different references, different perspectives. And I think it's like football team or any team, isn't it? You need that sort of different people with different points of view all working together to for a similar goal. Mm. And communication, right? So from the top down, the leadership, you know, I'm in a global position and it's great, but it's really important that I give back and I listen and take time out. You know, a classic example, there's some people started at the agency. I don't have to have a one-on-one with them, but I'm going out of my way to go, hey, how you going? I want to know you as a person first, rather than like, you know, and actually that makes my life difficult because it's 30 minutes, an hour of my time that I could really spend on other shit.
Mm.
But I think long term it's good because that person feels part of an organization. They feel listened to, they feel empowered. And like, I don't know, one of the other things about Wolf Olins without, you know, trying to sell it or anything like that is autonomy. I think it's an agency built on a culture of autonomy.
Mm.
It's like, okay, you're good at what you're doing. Otherwise you wouldn't be in what some people call the best brand consultancy in the world, but obviously not interested in titles. But like, you know, you've got to Wolf Olins. There's a certain level of expectation there. You're a grown up, make it happen. Rather than we're going to tell you exactly how to do everything. And everybody cooks in a different way. So that's cool.
I like how it's coming back to the kitchen
the
again.
The kitchen. Okay. Well, you know, I like food.
Okay, right. Well, I'm going to try and keep the metaphor, but it's not going to work with my question. When I think we spoke a long time ago about, I think you were doing a talk on neurodiversity.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is it's definitely a thing that, it was like a firework. Everyone suddenly started speaking about it. And I haven't heard much about neurodiversity like for a couple of years. I don't know why that is. Have you...
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably like a little bit partly responsible for that firework. I just felt like it was really important because I'm neurodiverse and like there's challenges, but there's also good things about that. You know, some people call it superpowers or whatever they want to call it. I thought it was important to include it in the conversation when we talk about diversity because invisible diversity, like, ADHD or dyslexia or autism or whatever is something that is hard to see. And I think, whereas I think there's loads of people who have those challenges or abilities, depending on how you look at it, they're both at the same time, can bring so much interesting thinking and flavor to work. You know, and it happens in the tech community with, you know, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Elon Musk, who are all lot neurodiverse, you know, and they celebrate it and make their cultures more inclusive. And I think in the design, advertising, marketing community, it was a bit like, oh, you know, if you don't act like this and work like this and whatever, then you get excluded. You know, and I think that's the wrong thing. I think it's about neurodiversity. Is about just, I just wanted to open up that conversation. And to be honest, I don't want to be the poster boy for neurodiversity. So I step back, and other people, I think, have taken it forward. You know, and awesome, and it's still there.
Yeah,
and people are still talking about it.
Definitely,
it's just probably with all the pandemic and the madness going on. You know, we're post-pandemic and now we've got cost of living or whatever. It's probably like not as obvious now.
It's somewhere in the pile, but it's not
at
the front.
Yeah, it's not in the pile. But HR people and other people are recognizing the fact that they need to change the way that they look for talent and find talent. You know, you guys are cool on that. And I think what's having that broad understanding of finding unusual, interesting people who can bring real superpowers to something is really important.
Can you think of a time where there has been, because I love the idea that, you know, ADHD, which I think we all have some sort of degree of it, unknown.
I think pretty much you look at the creative industry and it over-indexes.
But a lot of people say, like, it's my superpower. Then people go, oh, for fuck's sake, what do you mean? You know, I'd like to hear about an example of when there has been a superpower. Like, I think you said that you have Asperger's, right? Is that right? Or your son has Asperger's?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So when have you found that has been, you know, the having Asperger's has led to then that being a superpower in your case, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, there's not sort of a formula or anything like that, but I think it's just, I think allows you to see things in different ways.
Right.
So I think allows you to see sideways sometimes. So, which is good. I don't have eyes on the side of my head. Yeah. But like,
That's your broken knee.
Yeah, that's my broken knee. But I think it allows you sometimes to come from a different perspective, because you, I don't want to like big up myself or anything, so I won't go into any specifics. But I think, you know, if you come at it from a, even like back in the day, in a, you know, product design point of view, to go, oh, okay, I can see a clear answer to this. Why haven't people seen this answer and coming up with a product which now makes billions or whatever? You know, wish I would have owned part of that IP. But like, yeah, so I think it's like viewing something. Sometimes it's in a really simplistic way, or sometimes it's just seeing things from a completely different angle. And I think there's loads of examples of that within the industry from other people who are on the spectrum or dyslexic or whatever,
you know? I actually think it's, you're right, it could be so powerful, especially in product design where there's such a structure and a formula to adhere to,
yeah,
you know, with processes that are put in place and have been for years, that people are a bit afraid of breaking because they think, oh, then it's going to create bad work or the wrong type of work. But so having that and that sort of diverse opinion just brings a whole new perspective on it, right?
Yeah, and I think it's like any diversity. You know, if you come from a background or a class or a different place where you bring your different flavor, it just makes the work better, makes the solution more real, makes the sort of stuff stick. And I think it's all about just accepting all those unusual, weirdo, I'm allowed to say weirdo.
You can say weirdo.
You know, weirdo. Points of view in the world.
As a weirdo, what do you believe in that the rest of the world doesn't?
Ooh, okay. What do I believe in?
Or you can counter it. And what do you not believe in that the rest of the world is obsessed with?
I don't believe. The rest of the world, and particularly the design community, are obsessed with trends. I fucking hate trends. Because I think like a trend is here and there and it's sort of for a moment. And I think like I'm not interested in trends because I think what happens is like too many people get overexcited about a trend. You know, you take something really simple like, okay, everybody's sort of like rebranding with sans serif sort of typefaces and everything starts to look exactly the same, right? And it's like, okay, people copy trends and they sort of OD on trends and it becomes like this thing. And I'm like, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the stuff that isn't trendy because eventually that will become a trend, you know? And it's looking ahead, I think, I guess. Yeah. I'm so bored of trends, you know?
I want to stay on what pisses you off, actually. What else pisses you off about the industry out there?
Entitlement.
Ooh, what do you mean?
So I think there's a lot of people within the industry that, I guess the best way is to say, if you're going to be an artist. Mm. Don't be a graphic designer, you know, because I think we are a practitioner that's artisans, not artists. And I think what happens is a lot of people who feel, oh, I'm working in a great agency, I'm working for a great brand or whatever. I need to bring my flavor and fuck the brief. I just need to do this. And it's like, okay, I get it. But at the same time, it's like our job is to solve problems in cool, interesting ways. And I see us as craftspeople, not artists, because a craftsperson works to a brief. You know, if you want a beautiful car made or you want an amazing piece of furniture or whatever, you're working to a purpose to make it meaningful and real or whatever, to do something. Whereas an artist feels like, you know, they're working to their own brief. So I'm finding a lot of people come into the industry or are in the industry that have their own point of view and they feel they're entitled to push their point of view and not listen to what really needs to be done. And then the other thing, whoops, bumped the mic, sorry. The other thing that in the entitlement thing, it's like, oh, I want to do amazing work and I'm 22 and I want to be a creative director. Right? And it's like, no, you need to like a proper artisan, you know, if you're in Italy working in fashion or you're in Germany working on, you know, sort of something, you need to learn your craft. You build up that experience and like don't rush to be sort of like, I need to be a creative director working on Nike. I'm like the opposite. You know, I've had the opportunity to work on Nike and do amazing stuff. I'm like the best briefs. I love Nike, but the best briefs come from the shit briefs and the unusual, boring stuff that you get to change and turn around. And it's like, and enjoy the ride while you're there. Don't rush to be a creative director, you know, running a team. Man, the best time in my life was as a young creative when I had the chance to not worry about like people management and culture and stuff like that. And I could just focus on making shit. Basically, yeah.
I really like that. It feels like that's the part that gets forgotten now. It's the title chasing thing. Although you're seeing people going back and going, actually, I just want to be a doer now. I don't want to be this leader person.
Yeah, I think they've realized there's something nice about that culture of like making shit and doing stuff, you know, that we forget about.
Is there one of our like, I guess, big points we wanted to speak to you about was change. And I guess people not noticing that there is a change happening around them in the world.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you see that is changing that people aren't kind of noticing or moving to?
Oh, that's a big question.
It is quite a big one, isn't
it? Yeah. Change. I think if we sort that out, we'll sort the world out, basically. Yeah, apart from war and like whatever, you know, change, pandemic. I don't know. I don't know. What? Ask me that question again so I can fully
in. Is there change happening in the world, particularly, you know, within this industry or maybe not, where people aren't doing anything about it? Or perhaps the change is happening around them and they're refusing to change.
Yeah.
One thing we spoke about last week was Midjourney.
AI
coming along.
Yeah.
You've got people that are going, I'm not changing. That's going to ruin and take away my job, and you know the design shit, and you can't do anything with it. And then you've got the other crowd that are going, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This could be such a shortcut for so many things in my life. Like you type in words and it's a thought starter. I think that's one example, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that going on in the background from like the way that like part of the process has been enabled by technology now. Mm. You know, even the invention of Creative Cloud and all this sort of stuff, you know. It's the same conversation. I'm hearing the same conversation about AI I heard like when I first joined the industry about sort of other applications out there. Right. And it's probably the conversation also that like when the printing press was invented, they were going, oh my God, you're not going to do books by hand anymore. You're going to have a printing press. It's going to take away my job. Like, but it's like, I think creativity is not about like the tools that you use and design's not about the tools you use. Design's about like problem solving and like solving it through visual expression or through design thinking or whatever. And I think it's a natural tool. Yeah. I see AI as like, you know, amazing thing. And I think we shouldn't be afraid of it. We should learn how to deal with it because it's not going to go away. And that the Pandora's box, you know, now we've got what is it called? The text to video.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that by Stability AI in Munich, who have created that Stability Diffusion, I think it's called, application. And actually that is like, so I can type in like, you know, parrot with one leg riding a horse and it'll make a video.
Oh, really?
Goes video and it's like crazy. So the tools and stuff are out there. And I think, I think you need to embrace change, you know. Bruce Lee's the best. Like, to quote Emma, who's, like, my partner in crime at Wolf Hollands, who references Bruce Lee all the time. And I love it because I think Bruce Lee thing is, like, Jeet Kune Do, right, which is his martial arts style. There was karate and judo and all these very traditional static martial arts. Mm. He then created Jeet Kune Do, probably not pronouncing it right, sorry, but like based on offense and defense combined into one. So a punch and a block would become one movement. And everybody was, you know, sort of up in arms. How dare you change the rigor and tradition of martial arts? But like, it's a fantastic martial art. It's in a progression of things. Yeah. And I love the idea of we should always be changing and adapting ourselves and working with the tools and things, you know. Otherwise, it's like, go back and sit in a cave and paint on a wall.
Don't use paint though.
Yeah, don't use paint. Use
flint. No paint. What about which like city or place is welcoming that change the most?
Well, obviously there's the old haunts of like, you know, the Silicon Valley and all that sort of stuff. But I think the really surprising thing is like, you know, for example, in Germany, the guys who invented this, I think that came out of one of the Munich universities or something, this whole sort of a text to motion sort of AI. I was in Seoul recently in South Korea, and I think that's a really interesting country that if you talk about change, as a country that has embraced change, think about like the K-pop and the K-culture. And if you go to the V&A at the moment, there's an amazing there's a thing called the Korean Wave, which is put on, which maps the journey of change, you know, from a country that was, you know, been attacked by everyone and like in ruins, and then a country that now is whatever it is in the world, you know, amazing economy, doing amazing things, producing amazing technology. They've got 6G and making ships in a week that the Italians take sort of 6 months to make. Yeah, seriously.
What is this?
What's 5G? 6G, yeah. So they've got like, they've embraced technology, but they still are very humble and rooted in tradition as well. Yeah. And I love that balance, and maybe it's the whole yin and yang thing going on in their flag, but
they
I love
beauty
that.
Don't they, they're very into like beautification.
But like they're also very compassionate, as you know. And I think what's really interesting is that's a place that's really interesting to go to.
Korea. I was speaking to a designer from a really small agency that was kind of born in Japan. I was telling you this before, and the amazing thing about something like that and that they're operating in London as well is you're working on projects that are so vastly different to each other in terms of like the cultural differences and nuances in design and how different that is. And I feel like that's something that maybe I'm not seeing enough of in talent in London or yeah. even in New York is yeah. this sort of designing for a different culture or a whole different like tone of voice and audience. So I think, and I guess it comes back to the point of with Wolf Erlins in particular, is that something that you guys are looking to do more of in terms of working yeah. with different regions, different cities?
I mean, we are working with a number of like brands in Southeast Asia mm. and North Asia and stuff. And like, we're not like, we don't have dots on the map everywhere, like some mm. agencies, yeah. but like, because I do think like the best talent, and I'm probably biased here, everyone, I'll get loads of haters now. Yeah. I think the best talent are in places like London and New York, mm. San Francisco, you know, LA, because of those conurbations just attract those cultures, you know, and there's the heritage of design and things like that. But I'm not excluding different new places by any means. But like, as an Aussie who's sort of lived in six different countries around the world and sort of calls this place home, even though it rains too much. but like, I just feel like there's a great culture of creativity and heritage here. And I think what's really interesting is like, we work with loads of people all over the world, you know, Middle East, Africa, India, Southeast Asia, China, whatever. But they want to work with like, you know, our talent in these, you know, New York or London or San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know why, but maybe they have a maturity and whatever. But saying that, we have lots of people from different yeah. parts of the world.
That's and
bringing all that sort of like, I think Sarah, my CEO, calls it a fruit salad, which I love as a term.
We're back in the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. Back in the kitchen. Yeah, yeah. We're all a fruit salad of like all different flavors coming together. And I think that makes, I think, you know, it's like a great house party.
That's nice.
Mm, yeah. Like just that. Want all these different types of people.
Yeah.
You know, because it's interesting and cool and good shit comes out the back of
way
it.
Way more interesting that way.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you a question about stuff that I have no idea about.
Okay. So,
well, yeah, one of the
I might not have any idea.
Yeah, yeah. I have not an idea the yeah. whole way through. There have been lots of layoffs. There's a talk about heading into this recession. There's not talk. It's happening, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people are fearful. I think a lot of people are going, "Is it going to be me next?" We've seen design departments at big places like Snapchat, you know, mm. being culled, and suddenly a whole load of brilliant people are back on the market. Is there anything you would say to a designer or even a design leader as to how they can remain recession-proof?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's scarier for younger designers because they haven't been through a dip or a recession before. Mm. Like, you know, we're probably old enough to remember the financial crisis mm. and all that sort of stuff, you know, and before that. So you've sort of seen recessions and then you've seen them go. I'm pretty sure this will be just more of a sudden dip and then we'll come out because I'm an optimist basically. But I think from a design point of view, a couple things, you know, and like I don't know everything in the world by any means, but my sort of opinion is don't become a generalist, right? Because like what you have to think about is like what you're going to do after the recession and where's your career going to be and where you're going to be then. So I think it's like, and I'm going to frame that in like become a generalist specialist, right? Ooh. So that means like know what you're good at in an area, become really good at that craft or that mm. thing, but be have the ability to flex. You know, if you're into fashion, right? You know, you've got to be able to go, oh, I'm going to work in different areas and sectors of fashion. I'm not going to just be luxury or whatever. I'm going to stay in that cool shit. I'm going to be able to flex across different parts, but I'm going to bring my understanding of fashion or my art direction ability or whatever. You know, do that. Same with product design. You know, don't just stay like, you know, in one particular spot within sort of financial services. You know, broaden your product design ability, but still keep true to what you really want to do. Because I think when a recession hits, people don't want to hire people that just do everything. Mm. They want to hire people for specific tasks. Mm. So if you get, you know, made redundant or retrenched or lose your job or whatever, having something that you can clearly point at and go, what do you do? I do this type of stuff. Mm. I think that really helps you, you know, in the, if you're a younger designer or a designer out there. And then I think be flexible in, like, you know, we're in a big world, right? Just because, like, the UK is going into recession, it doesn't mean you can't work for South Korea or Australia or America or whatever. So be flexible. And I think what's happened out of the back of the pandemic is we've got more opportunities to sort of, like, be able to jam with more different people because we don't physically have to be together. Yeah. You know, we can be like remote or whatever. So those my sort of like, and keep learning and keep building and keep working on, you know, get your shit together. Mm. Really, I think people, if I was a designer that was worried about this now or a creative or whatever, I think you constantly have to be keeping your tools sharp, basically. Yeah. Keep your portfolio up to date. Make sure you do all the bullshit, like, you know, having things spelt correctly, or, you know, and networking and engaging with people and connecting with people who can help you, you know. Even if you're just talking to people like you guys and being on their radar, you know, rather than waiting till everything shit happens and then going, oh, what's plan B?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I was going to add that point as well. Like, mentors, I think, is just so important.
Yeah.
And maybe not for the short term, but it's so important that a junior designer, if I was a junior designer, I'd, as long as there's, I don't know, there's an openness from people like you to actually welcome that, I would be messaging you, hounding you about going for a coffee to just, like, just get some idea of what I should be doing next. Because I think that's the issue is, yes, it's recession proofing in terms of getting the right work out there and conceptualizing on different projects and stuff, but they don't know. There's a lot that they don't know, and who should they be sending that to? Who should be seeing that? So it's like this mix of getting mentors and leaders that, you know, can help you just give advice when they need, but also like social proofing yourself as well. Because all these people put amazing new websites together and online presence and expect everyone to come.
No one sees
running
that.
And then it's like, oh shit, no, I've got no emails from anyone. But so it is about putting yourself out there, which can be scary, right?
Yeah, it can be scary, but, like, you know, you don't get, like, have to be willing to take criticism, and you have to be willing to sort of take that on board in a positive way, right? You know, because it's going to make you work better and you better.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you very much, Wayne. Oh, one question on that, sorry.
It's, okay.
It's a stock question that I used to always ask, but Wayne Deacon, he's 20 years old. He's in front of us right now. There's a hologram. Thanks to Seoul in South Korea.
Yeah, yeah.
On 6G.
Or
8G.
He's faster than you are. What would you say to 20-year-old Wayne right now, do you think?
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, I fell into this industry late, right? So I had no idea I was even going to get in this industry. And I just wanted to surf and just hang out, basically.
Right.
And, like, and then I realized I needed to get a proper job. I would say, oh, come on, get going, get organized, have a point of view, think about what you really want to do. Because at that stage, I was sort of like unfocused. And I'm not saying, but then there's a part of me that goes, do you know what? That was great. Because I, like, did mad crazy shit that was probably illegal. And I did, went to interesting places and, you know, surfed some of the best places in the world and visited some really interesting things and got loads of stories that I can't talk about. But I think what's interesting is, I think that made me an interesting, well, I don't know, I like to think I'm interesting, but, like, made me sort of, gave me interesting perspectives and references. Yeah. So there's part of me that goes, hey, hologram Wayne Deacon, get your shit together and know what you want to do, because, like, you know, you had to work really hard to get your first job, and actually you could have done that easier. But there's another part of me that goes, oh, you know what, enjoy just being a bit crazy and mad,
yeah,
you know, and live the life, you know,
but in about 1 month, get your shit together. There goes hologram Wayne.
I was gonna touch on this one. I know it's maybe over talked about now, but the Figma Adobe acquisition.
Yeah.
Adobe bought Figma, for anyone who doesn't know, for $20 billion.
That's a lot of money.
Which is quite a lot of money.
Why did they?
It's actually about $23 billion, because the CEO is the and some of his employees are taking basically $2.5 billion, $3 billion in retention. like a retention scheme. But
So they stay and they get a £3 billion earner.
Yeah, I want to say like 4 years.
What does Adobe get from this? Why are they doing?
Well, I mean, I know this is going to be an interesting question to answer because you've got your Figma lovers and you've got your Adobe haters and Adobe lovers. And like, I'm not panicked. I love Figma. I think it's awesome. You know, I've done the whole sketch and everything to Figma world, but it's, you know, one of many. And I think the thing about the difference between Figma and Adobe is why people are getting upset about it is I think Figma is a community. It's a community-based design tool. You know, you can, it's updated, it listens to the community, it responds really well. Adobe was sort of, actually, even Adobe XD used to be like that when they did updates and iterations. They sort of like listened more to the community, but now it's like super slow getting stuff out. But Adobe as a suite of tools is amazing, right? I don't have any shares in it, or so I can say this. But like, because I'm technology agnostic. But I think it's great. And I think what people are fearing is like Figma's going to be like Adobe-ized. I don't know if there's such a word.
I like
you
that.
Know.
There is now.
Yeah, yes. and it's going to lose its soul and its mojo and stuff like that. I think it's no fear. I think Adobe have bought it for a reason that they think it's a great tool and application and they'll leave it alone. Otherwise, why are they paying the CEO to stay on? And why are they going, they just buy it and like do it. So for me, I feel like, don't worry, everybody. It's going to be cool. Figma's going to be there. It's going to stay. Adobe's going to do its thing. In fact, I think Adobe will learn lots of cool stuff from Figma.
Yeah.
And I think, and I look at it a bit like how Microsoft bought LinkedIn, right? Yeah. It didn't suddenly change. It got better.
Mm.
And it's as long as they keep its identity there and as long as they keep it as a community-based platform in a way and it gets that love and feedback in iterations because they can iterate on speed basically not on speed the drug but like at speed sorry but maybe it's at speed you know all these but like tech people but like but yeah I don't think
so you're optimistic I think about this
I'm really optimistic and I think like I love Adobe but I'm probably like really boring because I you know, there are bits that sometimes a bit slow and bloated in parts of their application that I could easily see they could change, but it's not my job to do that. But I think I think there's really cool shit. And what you need, again, coming back to tools, is loads of different tools in your box that you can sort of like pull on. Mm. So I think people's knee-jerk reaction to it is one of fear. And change, but change is good. Like back to your change question.
There it is again.
Just roll with it, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
What are you going to say?
I was going to say the devil's advocate.
Oh, dear.
Side of that. Okay. Not that intense, but I made that sound extremely intense. No, I'm just thinking for the designers who are getting into the industry.
Yeah.
Is that almost removed the very low barrier to entry because Figma's a free tool and Adobe is not? Is that almost, do you think that might put off a junior designer or someone who's just wants to get onto Figma, jam around, see if they can create some cool shit, and then now they're paying this subscription with Adobe, and that's going to potentially hinder pretty cool innovative work?
I don't know. I mean, have they definitely, I don't know if they've said it's going to be.
Sure. But knowing Adobe from being a student as a product designer well, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, just...
Maybe it'll go the other way around, right? Maybe it'll, like, teach Adobe to go, you know, the best behavior of product design is let people play with your product.
Mm.
Give it for free and then have a lightweight version and that more heavyweight version.
And just premiumize it.
And I think the problem with Adobe's is, like, their lightweight version is very restrictive what you can do compared to the full suite. And I think what Figma have done, to your point, which is like, you know, they've allowed the freedom and of people to play with their application. Yeah. And that's why I call it a community. So I think if they keep the community spirit and they don't mess with that, it could be an amazing thing. It might actually, you know, unfortunately, it might have to like live in the sort of the families, the suite where you have to click on the and it'll be a bit weird.
Adobe Figma.
Yeah.
I don't recommend
I'm like, what?
But I think but I think they'll leave it alone.
Yeah.
I think I think they'll leave it alone because they know they've bought something good and they've kept the C suite on. And I don't
and
think
you pay 23 billion.
Yeah.
You don't just buy it and go right. Oh, this hacks it. Okay, I'm wary that we haven't got that much more of the time. So this is the last question we're going to ask you.
Okay.
And we called this elephant vomit.
Lovely.
Right.
What would an elephant puke up? If an elephant was in this industry, what would they vomit out and go, fuck that, that needs to leave?
Yeah, I think I sort of touched on this in my previous question about the sort of entitlement thing. Okay. Yeah. So I should have saved that for the elephant. No,
well, that's why we say bring along three things. There's three things. Because that always happens. Someone goes, this is actually really doing my head in this one thing. And then, but I guess...
But I have another third one. I think the other third one is... I think there's too much an expectation on designers, creatives, to have personality. So it's like the good bloke or the good girl, you know, syndrome. If you can go down the pub and you can be mates with everyone and socialize and whatever, you tend to sort of like get further in this industry because you've got charisma or whatever, you know. And I don't think that's the thing that annoys me, right? Because like I used to be, believe it or not, quite shy, and I still don't like being in big groups of people. I find the noise a bit thing, and I don't like being, you know, I do talks and stuff, but I always think, oh shit, you know, I forget there are people there. But like I don't like big people and stuff, and I think there's loads of people with different challenges that don't want to play the game of being the good bloke or the good girl who's like, yeah, amazing, going to get all pissed together and have, you know, and be really charismatic. They just want to do their job and like get recognized for their skills they bring. And I think there's too much of a waiting on like in the industry of making people feel they need to be, you know, this enthusiastic, interesting, amazing, charismatic person.
Yeah. I really like that.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, the loudest person in the room gets the, you know, breaks through. And actually the quietest person usually has the better idea because they're absorbing everything.
Also, it's not in everyone's culture to do the drinking down the pub day with the obvious. I think, but they're expected to do that because this is the city and the culture that they've moved into.
And it's like we're not working in the city, you know, where we have to sort of go and get pissed with each other. You know, I think it should be more accepting from a cultural point of view is a really good point, and also just from a like personality point of view to your point, Ollie, you know, I don't think the loudest person in the room isn't the most amazing.
Although that probably is all of us now, the loudest person in the room, I'd say.
Wow, that's three loud people in one room.
There we go.
Love.
Well, look, Wayne, thank you so much. Yeah. I've loved this. It's been lovely seeing your face again. It's been
a long
time.
I'll give you a kiss later.
That'll be incredible. Yeah. Do it quietly. Well, no, thank you very much, mate. And I really appreciate you coming to see us.
No, I've enjoyed it. Thank you for listening to my complete nonsense.
It was perfect. Perfectly nonsensical.
Nonsense.
Yes.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.